think Miles Davis called him the greatest musician in the world. That's what Miles said. And I wouldn't argue with him, you know? He was certainly the greatest one I knew.
Gil's music was him. He was his music. It was like it was alive. You know, the music was alive. It was messy and beautiful and delicate and crude, just like life is.
He was the youngest old man I've ever met. You know, he was so into music. I think one of the things he taught me was that you never stop learning about music. And that, in a way, that keeps you young. Just keep learning, keep trying to get better.
His career as a musician, a composer, and especially a jazz arranger covered more than 50 years, from the early 1930s until his death in 1988. During that career, he became a master of the soundscape. He blended musical forms, instruments, and artists from anywhere and everywhere. He won great acclaim for his work with trumpeter Miles Davis, making recordings that rank among the all-time greatest artistic and popular successes in jazz. But there's much more to his story, as you're about to hear. I'm Nancy Wilson. On this edition of Jazz Profiles, the story of the legendary Gil Evans. Like all the great instrumentalists and singers, arranger Gil Evans had his own unmistakable voice. His sound came from an ingenious blending of music from all periods and styles, within jazz and outside of it. Composer and historian Gunther Schuller.
Gil's sound world is a very special one. I won't say limited, but there are certain soft, velvety, satiny sounds which he preferred. I mean, that was his sound palette, just like certain painters paint with only certain colors. He loved that quiet and darker color. And he would take those colors from wherever he found them, and he could find them in jazz in some cases, and he could find them in classical music.
It's what Gil Evans painted with these colors that sets his work apart. His writing is often described not as arranging, but as recomposing, the transformation of someone else's music into something all his own. Jazz writer Gary Giddens.
Most arrangers think that their job is the same job as a singer or an interpreter, which is to simply give the songwriter his song in the best possible light. Gil uses the song as a kind of jumping off point, and in the end he does precisely that. He does give you the most beautiful summertime you're ever going to hear, but nevertheless it's been completely transmuted into something else.
Another key to the sound of Gil Evans is his orchestration, the instruments he chose. He worked with many instruments rarely used in jazz, the French horn and tuba, for instance. Like Duke Ellington before him, Gil also wrote his orchestrations with specific performers in mind to play them. Soprano saxophonist Steve Lacy.
he would take an old trombone player and mix it with a young clarinet player and come up with a certain flavor that was unique. And then he would write a certain thing, and then he would tell you to moan when you play it. And the combination of this little instruction and what he had on the paper and the player that he wrote it for was magic.
Ballad of the Sad Young Men, from the 1958 Gil Evans album, Great Jazz Standards. Where did the magic of Gil Evans' sound come from? Where did it begin? One of the true architects of modern orchestral jazz, Gil Evans was born before this music even had a name. He began life on May 13, 1912, in Toronto, Canada, with the name Ian Ernest Gilmore Green. His father died shortly after Gil's birth, and he got the name Evans later on when his mother remarried. Eventually, the family settled in Stockton, California. It was here, when he was in high school, that Gil discovered jazz, Duke Ellington, Don Redman, and especially Louis Armstrong, Gil's lifelong hero and idol.
Actually, I learned how to handle how to treat a song and all that from Louis Armstrong. The first record I bought was in 1927, right? And it was called No One Else But You. It was him and Earl Hines and a band with the arrangement by Don Redman. It's great, even now. The rhythm section sounds old-fashioned, but it's something else.
Young Gil Evans learned to write and play music by copying what he heard on records, picking out the notes one at a time on his family's piano. And he kept up on the latest music by listening to the radio.
The radio was a big thing then in the 30s, you know. Every day you'd hear a band from New York, you know, at least every day. Duke would be playing from some supper club there or something like that.
Gil started his first band when he was still attending Modesto College in California. By the early 1930s, his Gil Evans Orchestra was a full-time occupation. It became a popular dance band, but by commercial standards, not a very successful one. By 1937, Gil was not able to keep his band employed, and he turned over its leadership to a popular singer named Skinny Ennis. Gil stayed on as the arranger for hire, and soon found himself working with Ennis in Hollywood. In 1939, they were hired as the house band for the Bob Hope radio show. He didn't enjoy this kind of writing, but it was steady work. It also led to a major turning point in his career, meeting another arranger and bandleader named Claude Thornhill.
I met Claude Thornhill in Hollywood. He came out there to write some arrangements for this band, Skinny Ennis' band, who was on the Bob Hope show. And I was writing arrangements for that show, too. Claude had an insurance policy that he was going to cash in, and he couldn't decide whether to go to Tahiti for the rest of his life or go back to New York and start a band, right? Which he decided to do, so I said to him, if you ever need an arranger, let me know, you know. So when his chief arranger got drafted, he sent for me, you know. That was in 41.
The Claude Thornhill Orchestra was unique among big bands for its rich orchestral style. Thornhill shared Gil's interest in classical symphonic music. But what was missing in this band was swing charts. That's where Gil came in. As you can hear in this next tune, his arrangements were lavish, sophisticated, and they were irresistibly danceable. Buster's Last Stand, recorded in 1942 by the Claude Thornhill Orchestra, and one of the very first Gil Evans arrangements on record. I'm Nancy Wilson. You're listening to the story of Gil Evans on NPR's Jazz Profiles. With World War II escalating, in 1942, Gil went into the Army. When the war ended, he rejoined Claude Thornhill and became the band's principal arranger. As a writer, Gil flourished during this period. However, by this point, the whole era of the big band was on its last legs. The music business changed dramatically after the war. So did the music. A revolutionary new music was emerging in small bands led by Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. It was called bebop, and Gil Evans became one of its earliest converts. Tunes like this one, Charlie Parker's Anthropology, inspired Gil to write bebop arrangements for Claude Thornhill's big band. These charts impressed even the bebop innovators themselves. Alto saxophonist Charlie Parker, who became good friends with Gil, and Parker's drummer at that time, Max Roach.
Gil was like an integral part of 52nd Street, and he was very generous with information to those people who were really interested in orchestration.
The 52nd Street that was really Jazz Alley, so to speak, was on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th Avenues. And Gil had a little basement apartment. So when we'd get off from between sets, we'd all go out down to Gil's place.
So I left the door open for 2 years. Just left it open. I never locked it. You know, when I went out, I never locked it. So sometimes I'd come home and I'd meet strangers. But most of the time I met people like Miles and John Lewis and George Russell.
Baritone saxophonist and composer Jerry Mulligan.
I wound up spending most of the winter there. The two of us in this room with people wandering in and out all the time. And the cat, Becky. We used to take turns using the piano to write. Also taking turns, you know, it's like our lives were kind of off-centers. When I slept, he wrote. When he was using the bed, I would write. And all the time, the guys wandering in and out. It was a great period because everybody was so totally engrossed with music and the things that they were doing.
Musicians were fascinated by Gil's use of bebop, and also by his wide-ranging interest in other musical forms. Another of the regulars at Gil's apartment was composer John Carisi.
Jerry and myself and George Russell, to some extent, we were there because we were picking Gil's brains. At that point, he was getting scores and things from the New York Public Library and records and scores and studying the modernists, you know, the 20th century composers.
Max Roach.
So everybody used to hang out in Gil's little apartment because, you know, musically, we discussed all the time different ways of doing things. And one of the most avaricious, if you would say, people was Miles Davis. Miles was just like, he couldn't get over this. He saw this was another direction.
That other direction Max Roach referred to would inspire one of the greatest partnerships in jazz and a lifelong friendship between Gil Evans and Miles Davis. Gil and Miles made history on their very first collaboration. That project began as little more than an experimental workshop. It culminated in what later became the legendary album Birth of the Cool. From Birth of the Cool, Boplicity, by Miles Davis and Gil Evans. The music of Birth of the Cool involved not only Gil and Miles Davis, but also the whole circle of writers that hung out at Gil's apartment. The experiment focused on things like different instrumentations, how to get the sound of the big band from a much smaller ensemble, and how to get new sounds, what Gil liked to call waveforms, by trying out different combinations of instruments.
The instruments have their waveform and all that, but the harmony means that you're putting together a group of instruments and they're going to get their own independent waveform, right? They can't get it any other way except as an ensemble.
The subtle, unusual, highly arranged sound they created in this ensemble opened a brand new chapter in jazz. It launched Miles Davis's career as a band leader, and it established Gil Evans as a true innovator. Gil created sounds that were new not only to jazz, but to music. As Gunther Schuller explains, that's no small feat for any writer.
There is hardly anything, harmonically speaking, melodically, structurally in terms of form, that hasn't been done long before in classical music. Having said that, there are moments of originality that are perhaps unique, that are unprecedented, that had never been heard before, and perhaps haven't even been heard since then. But they don't lie in the realm of harmony. They lie in the realm of sounds, of sonorities, of timbre.
This is Gil Evans' arrangement of Moon Dreams, recorded in 1950, a session, incidentally, that features Gunther Schuller playing French horn. ¶¶ Despite the impact of Birth of the Cool on musicians, it went unnoticed by the jazz public for many years. After the recording sessions, most of the musicians went back to their own bands. Gil didn't. With the virtual extinction of big bands, he had no band and no job to return to. In 1957, Gil's life changed dramatically, even spectacularly, when he reunited with Miles Davis for a new project. It was an album called Miles Ahead. Columbia Records had just signed Miles Davis, and this record was intended to present Miles not with his regular quintet, but in a larger, grander setting. What Gil proposed was a jazz suite, a concerto, built around the voice of one soloist. As Gary Giddens explains, the approach itself wasn't new. Duke Ellington wrote many suites for specific players, but Gil Evans took the concept in a completely different direction.
Gil Evans took that a whole other step because he created entire albums around artists. Now, clearly, he was the hired hand in these. He did not stimulate the idea. But what Gil did on that record was nothing like what any other arranger would have done. There's just nothing conventional about that record. First in the choice of materials, which uses contemporary jazz themes and also classical themes. And then, of course, he was the first person ever to write transitional passages between the selections. I don't think anybody did that again until the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper, 10 years later. So the two of them, Miles and Gil, created a work of LP art.
My Ship and Miles Ahead, from the 1957 Miles Davis album, Miles Ahead. Following the success of this record, Gil and Miles did another jazz suite, this one based on George Gershwin's 1935 folk opera, Porgy and Bess, became their second major hit together, and another jazz classic. Once again, Gil's arrangements were a perfect complement to Miles Davis's playing. Miles had always loved Gil's sound, and to Gil, Miles Davis was a sound innovator in his own right.
That's how we got together, basically, really, was the sound, you know. The sound is the thing that put us together immediately, you know. It's always been like that. It's still the same way today.
To many ears, the great sound of Miles Davis's trumpet was never better than when it was surrounded by the orchestral writing of Gil Evans. Gary Giddens.
Honing in on Miles the way he did and writing pieces that used his art in a way that nobody else had. For example, Sketches of Spain. I can't imagine another orchestrator doing that, especially because Gil practically is the invisible man. He almost completely stays out of his way. That's his job, is almost not to be there. In other places, he's everywhere. he does it all, and he does it, but he does it in ways that surprise you, and he does it in ways that conform to the needs and the genius and the talent of the soloist.
Concerto de Aranjuez, from the Grammy Award winner 1960 album, Sketches of Spain. Coming up, Life Beyond Miles. Gil finally records his own band and his own music. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to Jazz Profiles, celebrating the legendary arranger Gil Evans from NPR National Public Radio. Among jazz musicians, Gil Evans was already a giant back in the 1940s, first for his arrangements for the Claude Thornhill Orchestra, then for the celebrated Birth of the Cool sessions. But wider jazz audiences didn't know about Gil until he did the first Miles Davis big band project, Miles Ahead. Within months of the release of that highly successful album, Gil was signed to do a record of his own. Between 1957 and 1964, Gil Evans released 6 albums. These recordings showcase his talents as an arranger, composer, pianist, and a connoisseur of fine music. They also highlight his ability to attract the finest players, and as a band leader, to inspire them to play better than ever. Drummer Elvin Jones played on several of Gil's recordings in the 1950s and 60s.
He was such a great leader that he could speak individually to people and give them the sense that what they did was the most important thing that was going on there. That note that you play is essential. From that point of view, he brought about, I think, he brought out of the musicians the best that they had to offer.
La Nevada, from the 1960 Gil Evans album, Out of the Cool. Out of the Cool was acclaimed by jazz critics everywhere. In that same year, Gil and Miles Davis won a Grammy Award for another collaboration, Sketches of Spain. Yet, despite Gil's artistic success, he struggled financially. Sketches of Spain was his most lucrative project. But as the record came out, he gave up his publishing rights in a divorce settlement. And although his career was at a high point, Gil did less work, not more. It took Gil 3 more years before he started another major project of his own. In 1963, and a long and costly 16 months to finish it. The result? Much anxiety for the record company, but also the realization of what many regard as Gil's recording masterpiece. Las Vegas Tango, from the 1964 album, The Individualism of Gil Evans. After this record, Gil took on very little new work. He still collaborated often with Miles Davis, but he turned down almost every other offer. His financial problems continued. Elvin Jones.
He could have done a lot of things, but he would never lower his standards. You know, working these Mickey Mouse jobs or doing things like that, he just wouldn't do it. He could have made a lot of money, but he just didn't want to, he couldn't do it. He had his integrity.
Gil Evans cared deeply about his art, and he didn't compromise in the interest of making money. Yet he was never obsessed about his work, and he also enjoyed his time away from music. Gil remarried in 1964, and soon he and his wife, Anita, were raising 2 baby boys, born just over a year apart. Now in his early 50s, Gil was delighted to be a parent. Unfortunately, he still wasn't very good at making money. At first, Anita didn't believe that Gil could be so famous and yet so poor. Anita Evans.
Here's this famous white American who got famous and didn't make any money. This is weird.
This is very unusual. You know, it's hard to do in America.
Between 1965 and 1969, very little was seen or heard from Gil Evans. When he did resurface in the late 1960s, with a new band and a new album, the world was a very different place. And Gil Evans was a different man. I'm Nancy Wilson, and it's Jazz Profiles, with a tribute to the legendary arranger, Gil Evans.
He liked electric guitars. He liked loud music.
Alto saxophonist David Sanborn performed and recorded with Gil Evans throughout the 1970s.
He liked chaos. He liked, you know, density. And he liked silence. And he liked to swing.
In the 1960s, the jazz establishment was being shaken to its roots. On one hand, the music was drifting away from its core listeners as the experiments of John Coltrane and Ornette Coleman gained acceptance. On the other hand, rock and roll was taking over and finding its way into jazz. Gil's longtime colleague, Miles Davis, embraced this new musical fusion, and so did Gil. Forming an electrified band, Gil set about reinventing himself and deconstructing his own music. Gil now sounded totally different, but one thing hadn't changed, his influence on musicians. A younger generation was drawn to his music and fascinated by his personality. One of these young players was David Sanborn.
Just being around him, you just learned so much about life. You know, you just learned about life. I mean, my motivation for doing it was I enjoyed it and I learned. I learned about how great it was to play in an ensemble where it felt like every part that was being played was a melody part. Every part was beautiful and it all fit together. And you were just a part of these incredibly great textures.
¶¶ Not everyone liked Gil's new material or the new band. Many still preferred the classic Gil Evans style, featured in Sketches of Spain. Trumpeter Lou Soloff worked with Gil from the early 70s to the end of Gil's life. During that time, he saw Gil turn down countless offers for that kind of writing.
I mean, I do not want to name names, but it's unbelievable who approached him to work and make a lot of money for them, and he just blew it off. He just wanted to do what he wanted to do. You know, and I said something like, you could have made a fortune, you could have been really rich or something if you would have. He says, yeah, but then I wouldn't have my freedom. And he said, and then he laughed, and he says, on the other hand, I'm broke. But obviously that was his choice, and he was a happy man.
David Sanborn.
He didn't try to recreate the past. He didn't try to live in the past. It was like then. Because then you become the past. Then you become preserved in amber. And that's the death of an artist, is to be imprisoned by people's image of who they think he is.
Gil Evans.
Coleman Hawkins developed his sound starting around 1924, right? And he was the jazz saxophone player for 10 years, right? When Prez came along, people were outraged. Oh, everything that you could think of, they said about him, you know. You sound like an owl, why don't you play one? All that kind of thing. A new generation comes along and pick up on it. Then the innovator, if he's still alive and not a disaster, can get some credit, you know? But a lot of times, I mean, an innovator can come and go and not have a very good life, you know? Same thing happened with Coltrane. People were outraged at that sound, right? Why do you want to do that when the sound is so good up until now, you know? That's convenience, right? The world's most prevalent addiction.
Gil celebrated his 70th birthday in 1982. But instead of retiring or even slowing down, he got busier and bolder. It began with a Monday night stint at a little New York club called Sweet Basil. This soon became a permanent gig and one of the jazz events in the city. All kinds of musicians showed up every week to see Gil and often to sit in with the band. Audiences never knew who'd be playing or what would happen. The music was spontaneous and unpredictable, which is exactly the way Gil wanted it. French horn player and another longtime Gil Evans Orchestra member, John Clark.
He didn't like to give any directions. He didn't even like to call a tune. He would call a tune by playing a little bit of it on the piano. And then he would just wait until everybody figured out what tune we were playing. He didn't even like to count the tunes off. He would only do it in certain cases where you had to get everybody to start at the same time. But if we could start a tune by just kind of like drifting into it, that's what he would prefer to do. He just liked to sit at the piano, he loved to play, he loved to listen, but he didn't really want to lead the band. And he used to call it a leaderless band.
Clearly, Gil still was the leader of his band. But instead of imposing his own ideas, Gil wanted everyone in the band to pursue their own. That attitude had the effect of liberating the players and inspiring them to be even more adventurous.
Thank you.
Jimi Hendrix composition, Stone Free, recorded in 1984 by Gil Evans and the Monday Night Orchestra for the album Live at Sweet Basil. Another big change for Gil was that for the first time in 20 years, he started accepting some of the offers he got to work on other people's projects. Now, busier than ever, Gil immersed himself in every project he took on. Although his health began to decline, he never slowed down. In fact, 1987 was the most active year of his entire career. Gil, now at 75 years of age, seemed to be having the time of his life. His biggest project that year was a concert and recording session with the British singer and composer Sting.
To meet and work with musicians of that caliber, one, it's great, you learn a lot just by osmosis being with them, but it's also inspiring. It makes you realize that music doesn't end at 25. New things don't stop occurring to you if you're in the right frame of mind. You've seen a man very, very happy in his music and satisfied that he'd led a fulfilled life, and he was still living a fulfilled life, still in music, still playing the piano, still had a band, still performing. Well, she's walking through the clouds with a circus man that's running around. Butterflies and zebras and moonbeams and fairy tales. All she ever thinks about is riding with the wind.
The Gil Evans arrangement of Little Wing, written by Jimi Hendrix, from Sting's 1986 album, Nothing Like the Sun. Gil's next album, Paris Blues, turned out to be his last. Just a few weeks after recording it, Gil went in for a minor surgical procedure. Then he developed an infection. Serious complications ensued, and he didn't recover. Gil Evans died on March 20th, 1988, just a month before his 76th birthday. Gil's death was a shock to everyone who knew him. He'd been active physically and mentally, and his passing seemed inconceivable.
I don't think he ever lost that feeling of being the kid who learned to play the piano, the wonder of music that you get when you first start to play. There's a magic about it. I think that's his legacy. He never lost that sense of childlike wonder about music. Even though he knew so much, there was still more.
Steve Lacy.
You have to follow your dream wherever it takes you. I guess maybe that's the message from Gil, because he always followed his own tastes, his own appetites, his own dreams. He did what people asked him to do, but he did it his own way, and he did it with taste and knowledge and expertise and imagination. He had the most wonderful sonic imagination that I've ever encountered, really.
Thank you. The legacy of Gil Evans, the unique and unforgettable soundscapes he created with all of his music, has a permanent spot in jazz history. Like so many of the great innovators in any art form, he never stopped looking for new ideas. His whole life was about music, finding new sounds, new musical colors. Gil Evans died not at the end of his creative life, but in the midst of it, still growing, still searching, and still enjoying every minute of it. A Profile of Gil Evans was written and produced by Larry Hickok. Thanks to author and broadcaster Ben Sidran for his interview with Gil Evans. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. The assistant producer is Madeline Smith. Our website coordinator is Patrick Breslin. Murray Horwitz is NPR's Vice President for Cultural Programming. To email us or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's website at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts and culture an active part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.